The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now we have David Grimm, the editor for our daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on the passing of the passenger pigeon. The passenger pigeon, the last of which died out in 1914, is often used as a symbol of what unthinking humans can do to animals, basically make them go extinct. Now some researchers are looking to take us humans off the hook for the death of the passenger pigeon. So Dave, can you take us back to the time when these birds were in the billions?
That's right. And I want to say that we're not exactly off the hook, but maybe a little less on the hook than we were before, potentially. So it turns out that passenger pigeons used to be actually the most abundant bird in the world. There were 3 to 5 billion of them in North America alone. They had these enormous flocks that were as wide as a mile and many miles long. So a very, very populous bird. They also became very popular as the targets of human hunting. It was a lot of cheap meat flying up there in the sky, not just for humans, but for livestock as well.
So what was the thinking at the time about why these birds went extinct?
Well, the simple thinking was that it was just a matter of overhunting, that humans were killing so many of these birds that they decimated the population and the bird eventually went extinct.
Sounds reasonable. The U.S. population was growing. The birds were being hunted. Why any doubt?
Well, some researchers had their doubts because you can imagine, how do you go from 3 to 5 billion birds to 0 birds over the course of a little over 100 years? Some researchers had suspected that there may be something else going on. In this new study, researchers gathered DNA from passenger pigeon samples, which are still available at some museums around the world, and they compared that to the DNA of the passenger pigeon's closest modern relative, which is the domestic pigeon. And by looking at these differences in the DNA, the researchers can actually tell how healthy the populations of the passenger pigeons were in the past. The more genetic diversity you have tends to be the more healthy a population is, the bigger the numbers have. And what the researchers found that was really fascinating is that they saw these really big spikes and troughs in passenger pigeon population where there could have been fluctuations of up to 1,000-fold differences in how many birds were around at any given point over time.
Do they have any idea what might have caused these ups and downs in their population?
Well, the researchers say these massive fluctuations aren't really typical for any other species. They think these birds were highly dependent on the availability of acorns, which was really their primary food source. So if you had years where acorns were in short supply, you had a lot of these birds dying and vice versa.
So is this path to extinction, the path that the passenger pigeon took, something that we should look out for in other species?
Well, what it does suggest is that although humans likely played a very large role in the extinction of these birds, that there may have been other environmental factors as well, and we should take those into account when we look at other endangered species.
Next up, we have a story on fishing spiders. As soon as I started reading this story, I immediately went to Google to look up fishing spider pictures, and I saw a lot of slightly disturbing images of spiders near the water, but no images of an actual spider grappling with an actual fish. But what's amazing to me is that the researchers took a similar approach, and they got a lot more, they got a lot better results. Did you take a look online, Dave?
I haven't looked online yet, but if you go to the website, we've actually got a really cool slideshow that will show you pictures of spiders actually catching and devouring fish, if that's your bag. But yes, the researchers took that approach. And the reason that the researchers took this approach of going onto Google and looking for images is that it had been known for a while that there are a few species of spiders around the world that do catch fish, which is actually pretty remarkable. These aren't giant swordfish that they're catching. They're more kind of small minnow type fish, but still impressive that a spider could catch and eat a fish. The researchers in this study suspected there was a lot more of this going on, and there just wasn't a whole lot of research out there. And the problem is, when you don't have a lot of research, you don't have a lot of papers, hence the researchers turned to Google Images. And they, being professionals, actually found a lot more pictures of fish-eating spiders than you did, Sarah.
So I was kind of surprised to learn that spiders have such a varied diet. And looking at the pictures, it looks like the spiders just hang out by the water. How do they actually grab up a fish?
Well, it turns out it looks like what they're doing is they feel for vibrations in the water, just like some species of spiders feel for vibrations in their webs to know whether they've caught an insect. And what they sometimes pick up is they pick up the vibrations that fish cause when they swim through the water. And sometimes they're catching fish instead of the other things they prey on, whether it be insects, or sometimes some of these species even eat frogs, snails, even birds and bats. So these spiders aren't terribly discriminating.
And once they get the fish or one of these other larger animals, what do the spiders do with them?
Well, what they do is a little bit gruesome. They actually drag the fish to dry land, and they can spend hours pumping these fish full of digestive enzymes and sucking the nutrients out until nothing is left but scales and bones.
Next up, we have a story on enterprising desert beetles. The beetles we're talking about here have a special adaptation for collecting water in extremely dry temperatures. So how do they do it, Dave?
This is a beetle called the Namib Desert Beetle. And what's really fascinating about this animal is it's got this really intricate pattern of water-attracting and water-repelling molecules on its wings. And what it does is it angles its body into the wind, and it uses this pattern of molecules on its wings to actually gather water from the air. Turns out the water in the air is attracted to these molecules on its wings, and the molecules on the wings actually help the water stay attached to the beetle, and the beetle is able to drink the water up.
So in this study, the researchers actually tried to emulate this very intricate design using carbon nanotubes. What does this device look like?
Well, carbon nanotubes, as the name implies, are very tiny cylindrical structures composed solely of carbon. In this device the researchers constructed, they basically created a forest of these nanotubes. They're about 1 centimeter high, and they're trying to really mimic what the Namib Desert Beetle does with its wings. They created a layer of molecules that draws water into the forest, and also a layer that traps this water once it's been drawn in. And this is all done without any sort of external power source.
How much water can this tiny sponge squeeze out of the air?
Well, the researchers found when they created a forest that was about 0.25 square centimeters, so pretty tiny, it pulled in more than a quarter of its own weight in 11 hours. And this is in a pretty dry setting. When it was placed in more humid surroundings, its efficiency increased and it collected about 80% of its weight in just 13 hours.
So how feasible would it be to scale something like this up?
It turns out carbon nanotubes are incredibly expensive. So you shouldn't expect to be able to roll out a mat of these guys in a desert anytime soon and survive the night. And researchers are actually saying that they're so expensive that perhaps we should look to other materials that might be much more cheap to manufacture. But the important thing here is the proof of concept that we can actually do this, that we can actually create a device that sucks water from the air. And this could be really valuable for communities that live in very dry areas.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about why sunlight could make you high. Also a story about why the bright center of a galaxy has gone dark. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we got a story about how journal bundling practices are causing some universities to pay much more for scientific journals than other universities do. Also a story about a controversial plan to study 100,000 babies in the U.S. from birth to the time that they are 21 years old. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.